what's going on? Maybe I'll get that new intro for the pod soon. But in the meantime, I'll just use Showdown Hoedown because it's kind of the brand. Look, I got the hat on. What's up, guys? I have just recorded episode 3 of season 2 of the Degenerate 75 Talks. Golf, market out, sports with smart people. And I had a great little chat with my dude, DB, from the Tour Junkies. We talked about mainly the Masters. I'm not going to lie to you. If you don't want to hear about the Masters, you might want to click off now, Bob. But, I mean, what a great week to talk about the Masters. As I've heard, the Masters is coming up soon. So we talked about that. We talked a little bit about everything. But mainly, there's just so much I did not know about Augusta. I had to have this guy on. I wanted to chat with him. I wanted to know a little bit about it. And so we had a great chat. You can't hang out with DB and not have a good chat. If I don't go to Georgia and drink some beer with that guy one day, I know nothing about life. So I hope you enjoy this show. Continue to check it out. Don't forget, if you're just finding this one, go watch episode 1 with Peter or episode 2 with Big T. Also great watches. Put it on while you're driving. Put it on while you're at work so you don't have to actually do any work. Do whatever you want, mother father. But anyways, I'll talk to you later. All right, here we go. Episode 3 of season 2 of the Degenerate 75 Talks Sports Golf. It'll probably be a lot of golf today. Not going to lie to you, new guy, with smart people. And today I have one of my new BFFs in the industry. His name's David Barnett. I tried to get Pat to come on too. I couldn't quite do it, but he is from the Tour Junkies. And if you want just great PGA content, there's like two people I listen to every week, and the Tour Junkies is one of those two. So if you want to listen to great content, go check them out. How you doing today, David?
Good. I'm good, dude. Happy to be here along with you and the Mother Father community. Yeah, you're continuing to crush it. Just, you know, a couple of recent full timers here, you and me. You know, we're both dipping our toe in this thing. We're both over our head in Masters content. But it's the best time of the year, man. I'm pumped. Golf season is about to get really started.
Yeah, you saying that you're full-time now. First of all, that's incredible to be doing PGA content full-time. I want to dip back to that at the end. Do not let me forget to come back to that. I'm going to put full-time. I'm writing it down right now. All right, so I already see you with the Masters. I'm already burying the lead. Every show, I got to begin with this one. I don't know this, but I'm going to make some big assumptions. You look like a good golfer. So I have to ask, how strong is your golf game?
You know, I was just talking to Pat about this because I've got a friend of mine coming to play Augusta with me on Monday before the Masters. He's from Philly. And I was like, dude, he thinks I'm good. Like, my buddy thinks I'm good and I'm not. And Pat's like, well, he plays like 5 months a year and he's probably going to shoot 110 on your golf course. So he's going to think you're good. But I think I'm bad. I'm an 8 handicap and I've been stuck at an 8 handicap for probably, I don't know, six years. Despite trying to break through and take lessons from our pro and all these things. I don't know. I don't feel like I'm that great of a golfer, especially at my club. The guys I play against are freaking good. And, but I don't know. I don't feel like a good golfer.
So well, here's my theory on golf. It seems like, at least for most of the people, me and most of the people I've met, like golf, you get better pretty quickly, you know, just like kind of figuring some things out and then you plateau forever. And I've been plateaued for 6 years.
Yeah. It's really hard to break through. Like, yeah, I mean, like breaking 90, breaking 100, you get there quickly. Sometimes breaking 90, you can get there. Then getting out of it, that's what I'm just so sick of. I tell our head pro every year, I'm like, dude, I just want to easily be able to shoot in the 70s. Mm. I don't care if it's a 79, a 78, a 70. It doesn't have to be a 71. I just want to be able to do that. But I cannot stop shooting 84s and 83s and 86s and with the occasional 78, you know? Right. And I can't get there.
I'll just be an 80s king till the day I die. 82 is like, I'm Tiger Woods. 89 is just me. That's just who I am.
You know what I did do? Like, my problem is, so I play at Champions Retreat, which is the host site of the Augusta National Women's Amateur going on that just happened the last 2 days of this recording. You can kind of spray it a little bit off the tee at Champions. Mm-hmm. It's all about the greens and the green complexes. But I hit so many foul balls off the tee. And if I could straighten that out and eliminate that, my floor would come way up. One day in the summer, this past summer, I was so pissed at myself because I could not hit anything with a club face, like with a head on it, driver, three wood, nothing. I went to the car. I was going to go play. I was like, I'm putting everything that's got a head on it in the car. I don't even want to have it in my bag to be tempted. And I have this 2-iron that I love. And I played the whole round. Longest club in my bag was a 2-iron. I shot a 78.
Wow.
Because I didn't have OB balls, you know, costing me a double bogey or a triple bogey.
You had the old Gary Woodland, let's just club down strategy. I love it.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's the course that you need. So you said play Augusta. First of all,
Sorry.
Waiver. I'm an ignorant fuck. I know you're not going to be on Augusta National, course, the Monday before the Masters. I know you're a big deal, but I don't even think the president can get that done. So, what is the course you're playing? I don't know all the prestige around there, layout.
Sorry. My buddy from Philly is coming to Augusta for the Masters for the first time. We're going to go to the tournament, the practice round on Tuesday. But we're playing at my place on Monday, which is Champions Retreat. So you're playing in Augusta Masters Week at Champions.
All right. Hey, and I got to ask this question because I've learned that the thing that's been shaving the most strokes off my game has been the old Texas wedge. So I love playing courses that have the mowed down edges. Is that a course that you're going to go play? Does it have the shaved edges all around? You said the green complexes. Tell me they're shaved down, like the really short rough around there.
Champions tends to have a decent amount of like the shaved down fringe-ish area. But then we have like Bermuda, kind of dormant Bermuda right now on the outside rough. So, in the summer when it's kind of lush, it's like just, inch long Bermuda rough, so it's not like super tightly mown down, but I mean, obviously in the fairways it is, but if you're in the rough long of a green or something like that, then you're dealing with Bermuda rough balls probably nestling down.
All right, so I'm getting to the stage of my life where I have got to go to the Masters. Like, I just got to go.
Yeah, dude,
I know I'm in the lottery every year, but, I'm not noted for my good luck. So, like, practically going to the Masters, like, practically going. Surely you can buy tickets secondhand, right? People can win the lottery or already have them, and they can go sell those on a third-party vendor or something, right? Yep. Like, how outrageous do those tickets get? Because to be honest, I've always been too scared to even look. Are we talking $2,500 a ticket? Are we talking $10,000 a ticket? I don't even know.
Yeah, I mean, it fluctuates. My whole life, it's fluctuated. There was a season when I was like a young 20-something-year-old hustling that I did like a little bit of ticket brokering, and that was madness, extremely stressful. But there are fluctuations throughout the year. The ticket has gotten increasingly more expensive and more exclusive. The more the Masters leans into like these big corporations and hospitality to these big corporations and stuff, the less tickets are going to these regular folks like you and I who apply in the lottery. So it becomes more of it's becoming more of a high ticket, item. But you can still definitely do that. So here's what I tell people. So my buddy from Philly, just like you, he was like, I've always wanted to go. My brother and I have always said we want to take our dad. He's never been. He's getting older. Like, we've always said we want to do that, and we've never done it. And I said, listen, this is what you do. If you've never been to the Masters and you don't have thousands of dollars to blow on a badge, because like a four-day badge right now, so the four-day badge meaning Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So it's one badge that gets you in all 4 days. One of those badges is going for like anywhere from $6,000 to $8,000 right now for one badge to get you in those 4 days. Okay.
Surprisingly cheaper than I would have thought. I mean, that's very expensive, but like, I don't know.
So what I tell people is, like, one of my favorite days to go, I've been almost every year of my life since I was 13 years old, is Tuesday. I love going on Tuesday. I'm going this Tuesday with my buddy from Philly because, the Masters is not like a PGA Tour event. You go to a PGA Tour event during a practice round. On Monday, literally no one hardly plays the course. Mm-hmm. On Tuesday, the best they're going to do is play nine holes. On Wednesday, the best they're going to do is play nine holes. These guys don't play full practice rounds. At Augusta, they get there on Sunday, sometimes Saturday. I'm going out tomorrow for the Augusta National Women's Amateur Final at Augusta. There will be guys there tomorrow, like on the chipping green, out on the course after they close it down. They are going to play and practice every single day. So you can see on Tuesday, you're going to see every golfer who's there. Every golfer is going to be there. They're probably going to play 18 holes, and they're going to hit a couple of shots on every hole. They're going to chip from a couple places. It's a laid-back atmosphere. The course is in immaculate condition. You can walk it everywhere. The pro shop is fully open. The cheap food and beers are all there and available. It's fantastic. So I think a Monday, Tuesday, if you've never been, you just want to go and you don't want to break the bank, that's when you go, okay? Now, how to get a ticket for that? If you can't get one in the lottery, yes, you can go to StubHub. You can go to these third-party situations. They're always going to be more expensive on those platforms than they are if you are in town and you walk into some hospitality place or you walk up to some dude on the street selling you a ticket. The fees on StubHub, and I mean, you probably know this, just going to a concert, right? Like, whatever the advertised price is, by the time you check out, it's like twice the price.
Exactly, right.
But so what I tell people is the best thing to do is get here on like Sunday, drive on Sunday before, have a place to stay if you really want a last minute this thing, and then Sunday night, you need to be going into some of these places, going to people on the streets on Washington Road and asking for, you know, if they've got any Mondays or Tuesday tickets for sale. If you can't get in on Monday, do the same thing on Monday. There's so many tickets that pop up locally from, you know, hospitality places where guys don't show up, or, you know, somebody's sick and they're not here. And all of a sudden now they've, you know, this place has 30 extra tickets. So many things pop up last minute that you have to be here to be able to grab it and get your ass on the course. Yeah. So, you know, that's what I would recommend, but you can also just buy the ticket ahead of time. And for a Tuesday ticket, you're probably talking anywhere from like 600 to
how big is Augusta? Like, did they have accommodations, like hospitality, hotels and shit for all these people? I have to imagine that I would think it, I would be shocked if it's over 100,000 people, but maybe I'm completely wrong. Is it?
Yes. It's the second largest city in Georgia.
Shut the front door. No, is that really?
Yeah, Augusta, the surrounding area of Augusta is like 400,000 people. Yeah,
holy shit. I need to get out and live life a little bit. That's insane. 400,000 people is a lot.
The coverage that Augusta gets really frustrates me as a local who's been here my whole life. Like, all they do is they cite Washington Road, which is one freaking road, and there are parts of Washington Road that are cool and nice, and there are parts that are old as shit and not nice. And the people closer to the National that are not like great spots, they're literally just sitting there waiting on the National to buy their property. So they're not going to sell it to some new development that wants to improve it. They're waiting on the National to come knocking on the door and get their heart right and their pencil sharp, which the National is doing every single year. They own so much property on Washington Road that people are not aware of. It's crazy.
Why are they buying up property? Well, this is what I wanted, John. This is all like fascinating news to me. Why is the National buying up property on Washington Street?
Dude, I mean, I can't begin to know all the reasons why, but all the rumors are things like, one day, you know, in our lifetime, we may see a women's course potentially. We may see different levels of hospitality. Like when the Augusta National does hospitality, when the Masters does hospitality, you know, you go to a PGA Tour event, hospitality is a tent they pitch the week before, right? Mm-hmm. Augusta National hospitality are full structured, gorgeous buildings with, you know, that are permanent, right? It could be added hospitality from that point. It could be player housing for the week instead of these players renting houses around locally in Augusta. Who knows? They're also doing it because they, you know, like all the food is prepped in a building outside of the gate. All your food Masters Week is in a building that's probably 500 yards from Magnolia Lane's gate. And then they have underground tunnels that go under Washington Road, that from that building under Washington Road, so they don't have to cross in traffic, that goes straight to the dining, whatever, inside the National. There's underground tunnels all under Washington Road that they're buying. And they just have they have more money than God. So, like, they just own everything.
Is there a chance that the National, which, by the way, I didn't even know that was their nickname. I'm talking like I know this stuff. The National. I assume that's just the group that runs the Masters and all the surrounding stuff.
It's called the National. Locals, we tend to say, like, oh, the National.
Well, I'm going
to
call it the National because I want to blend in. So, is there a chance that, like, what you're describing here, this sounds like the Illuminati. Are they going to become – is there a chance they can become more powerful than the PGA one day? Because, I mean, the PGA, you'd be lying to yourself if you said that all these guys leaving to live didn't kick them in the nuts a little bit. And it sounds like, you know, no one, the Masters has not been affected by any of this nonsense. So is there like a time in the next 30 years where the Masters could actually hold more power and prestige than the PGA does?
I think they already do it, honestly.
Old.
And there's also a lot that the Masters does that we all see and we all hear about. We all, you know, are going to see when Fred Ridley, the chairman, does his press conference next week. But there's also a lot that the National influences and those men and women that are members influence that we don't see. But I guarantee you that Augusta National and the membership there are very in the ear of Jay Monahan, just like they're in the ear of Mike Wan at the USGA or Martin Slumbers at the RNA. Like, they are as influential as you think you see them appear on the outside, they are probably three times more influential that you don't see. Mm. So I think they already are, honestly.
That's crazy. So, all right. So, this is why I needed to talk to you about this. My next question about the Masters is, I think most people would agree the Masters is the most, you know, prestigious of the four majors, right? And I want to know why that is. My working theory, and I think the safest answer would be, is that, you know, it's the one place that's played at the same course every year. You know, everybody knows about it. Is that the reason, or is there more to it? Is it, you know, like, I mean, of course the course is great, but let's be honest, a lot of the courses at other majors are tremendous too. So yeah. Like, what makes the Masters the best one?
I think what you say in terms of like it being the same place every year at the same time, there's so much to unpack there, because what we get with that is all these memories, right? And you know, we're all getting older, right? I'll be 40 this year. My wife just turned 40. I'm sitting here looking at my kids shooting up. I'm like, God, what is happening? Time is just running by. And you know what? The older I get, the more that I realize is such a drug is nostalgia. Like, that's the phrase, nostalgia is a drug. And it is, you know, and I think the Masters gives you so much of that nostalgia as you continue to watch it year after year. You can remember certain shots and certain players and certain moments and experiences. All that adds up, whether consciously or subconsciously, and it just, you have this feeling about it when you talk about it, when you watch it, when you wake up for it, when you're building up to it. So I think that's a lot of it. And I think the other part of it is just how well that, people do not understand how well this tournament is executed, which obviously if you run the same tournament at the same event every year, and guess what, you only have to do it 1 week a year, and you have all the money that you could ever need, you should be able to do it really damn well. But they continue to just execute that tournament and that event, not just for the patrons and for the viewers on TV, but for the players, their families, their caddies, their personnel. They continue to do it at such an excellent level, and even in some ways surprising level, that it just continues to just grow and snowball into the greatest. I mean, it is the greatest run sporting event in the world.
All right. I got to tell you, the one complaint I have about the Masters, and I don't have many, I love the Masters, is the limited field.
Okay. Me too.
It drives me nuts. Can you explain to me why they're so, like, you know, rigid about opening? I mean, first of all, what? It's going to be maybe 90 guys, 89 or 90 this year?
89 at the most.
Yeah, at the most. And that's if somebody wins, someone unique wins over at Valero, right? So why are they so reluctant? And that, you got to remember, 20 of those guys are, like, amateurs and, like, old farts that, like, can't play at all anymore. So, you know, why are they like that? And could you ever see them changing? And should they change? A three-part question.
I think they should, man. I'm the same way. I literally, if I sat down and made a list of complaints about the Masters, that would likely, I can't think of anything that would surpass that on the top of my list. I'm with you. I don't know. I don't know the meaning of that. I don't know why that is, unless it's just like they want it to be so exclusive and so prestigious. Right. They don't want so many people being able to get in it, which I understand, but it also doesn't have to be 150 people. Like, I would love 110, you know, and let's keep the top 50 in ties. If, you know, if we want to do that, let's, so I'm with you, man. I hate that. I don't know why they do that. I do think that you're seeing some, you're starting to see signs of some opening of the door for other areas. For example, there's one amateur playing this year, Gordon Sargent, which if you haven't heard of him, I think you probably will soon. He's the number one ranked amateur in the world. He plays at Vanderbilt. He hits the ball farther than, you know, I mean, God, he is amazingly long. Number one amateur in the world. Like, he will be on the PGA Tour very soon. He's probably getting starts this year at some point. They made a special invitation. If you look at the Masters qualification list, you know, they always say we hold the right to reserve any special invitation we want for any reason. So like, if Ricky doesn't win this week at Valero, they could just make a special invitation to Ricky and he's there. Right. But this guy is a special invitation and they haven't notated why, but I think what they're doing is they gave him the award because he won the NCAA individual title. Mm. And we know the Nationals history with amateur golf with Bobby Jones. They're always going to honor stuff like that. But that's not something that previously they've let in. So that might be a new qualification now. Now, that's just one player. But that might be a new qualification now. And hopefully we see more of those to expand the field.
When you're there, when you go to the course, this is an outside perception. I've always worried, well, if I do go there, the one thing that would drive me nuts about the Masters is it seems like it would be stuffy as fuck. Bunch of old stuffy guys that take themselves way too serious and act like their shit don't stink. That is the outside perception. So, like, is that a real thing? Because to me, it seems like it's a whole bunch of old Southern money down there that is, you know, very set in their ways and, you know, well, it's how we feel and that's how it's going to be. And I don't know if that's the real perception, but that's the perception I have, which, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I get that perception. I do. And obviously, a lot of that probably stems back to its early history. And But I think the Masters has also demonstrated such a willingness to change and evolve and do new things. I mean, the drive, chip, and putt, the, you know, Augusta National Women's Amateur. They're also doing all of those things. But I had a firsthand experience there. I don't remember if we talked about this when I was on your show last time, but I caddied there for 2 years in college. I was a full-time caddy for 2 years. And, you know, I'm caddying for members and their guests. And my experience with the membership is, you know, yeah, is there a sizable population of old Southern, you know, white rich dudes? Yes, there is. But it's a lot more diverse than you think it is. And not all of those old Southern rich white dudes, you know, are going to be assholes. I honestly, I would love to one day be an old Southern rich white dude. Like, I'm a white dude. I'm Southern. I'm getting older. I don't have the rich part down yet, but like, I'd love to check all four of those boxes at some point. I just want to also be a nice guy, which for the most part, Southerners are. There were some that I caddy for that, you know, I wouldn't say their name, but if I saw I was on their bag, I was like, well, this is going to be a shitty day. He's going to treat me like shit. He's going to tip me like shit. And
they're gonna be the judge from Caddyshack. That's what.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Judge Smales or whatever.
Yeah.
But there's plenty of nice guys too, man, and nice ladies that work there or that are members there. So.
Sad yeah. confession. I expect shame for this. I have never seen Caddyshack from beginning to end. I've probably seen really? Every scene in it. You know, like just bits and pieces I've watched. Yeah, I've never sat down and watched the whole movie in one setting. Is that? Can you be a golf guy and that be the case?
I don't think you can, James. Right. I think you need to do that. I think you need to check that box.
I'm going to come right back to the Masters, but seeing I've already taken it in a weird movie direction, best golf movie of all time. I'm going to tell you mine, and I can't believe people disagree with this, but to me, it's Tin Cup. There is so many great rewatchable golf scenes in Tin Cup. Yeah. I mean, my God, it's the best golf movie ever. And people that say like Bagger Vance and stuff, I'm like, okay, whatever. You like serious movies. I want a movie that I just enjoy watching for 2 hours. And you can just put that on and flip to any scene and I'm happy.
Yeah. You know what? I don't really think there's been a lot of good golf movies.
You're right. There hasn't.
I mean, Caddyshack is good. It's a classic. I think you need to watch it. And but like Happy Gilmore, of course. And that was my, you know, I'm a kid of the 90s. So, there's nostalgia associated with that, but it's when I watch it back now, I'm like, okay, this is all right. It's not, there's so many good football movies, yeah. like classic football movies.
Yep.
And I don't really feel like there's been a lot of good golf movies. Right. I don't know that I have.
And the way Hollywood's going now, don't hold your fucking breath because all they do now is just fucking remake movies from the 90s or just superhero movies. That's all shit is anymore. You're never going to see an original golf movie right now.
Yeah.
There'll be some shitty Tiger Woods movie in like 10 years and it'll be so bad. So bad. Okay, back to Master. I'm sorry, I had to divert there. I want people to know my favorite golf movie is Tin Cup because I've been amazed at how many people fight back on that. Like, there's some like Tin Cup haters out there. And I'm like, how could you not enjoy Tin Cup? Like, there's just some great scenes.
Kevin Costner, Cheech is in there.
Yeah. Oh my God. The one where they break all the clubs and he finishes out the round with a 7-iron. Love that one. So good. He goes back to the clubhouse. He's like, I just parred out with a 7-iron. Have you ever done that? He's like, you know what? It never even crossed my mind to try. It's like, that's just good banter.
Good, dude.
Okay. All right. What's your favorite hole at the Masters? Because I got, and that's a really hard question because there's like, to me, like five just truly epic holes at the Masters. They're all great, but five of them really stand out. But if you had to pick one, what would you pick and why? I'm just throwing questions at you with no preparation. I'll give you a second to think. All right. So here you go. Hole 12. Okay. That's the little par three over the water where Jordan Spieth imploded. What was that? 17, 2017, 2018. 16. Oh, was that 16?
I had a Danny Willett 150 to 160.
That was when the whole community won. Yeah. I remember that. He was like five clear and then he dunked it twice. That tee shot there on three. To me, and we've established, a very average golfer, does not look particularly intimidating. If I were standing over it, I'd be like, well, that water, I can definitely clear that water. Okay, I've got a nice big green, just got to worry about that bunker up front there. But to see those best players in the world, I don't know if it's the nerves, but they struggle with that hole. For a hole that doesn't look particularly intimidating, it can put a double bogey on you, or a quad if you're Jordan Spieth real quick. And, you know, holes that are secretly tricky like that, I just love. They can also stick it to 3 feet and have a tap in birdie. That's also an option there too. So I'd have to say 12 just because it is the most intimidating hole that doesn't appear to be intimidating.
Yeah, and I love that about it. Right, it's a hole that's it's like every par three on the tour now is 225 yards. Right, so you're not having to do that. that hole is so gettable, and they will hit it to 3 feet if two things: the flag is middle or left, mm-hmm. or there is hardly any wind. And Augusta's not a windy place at all. Like, it always cracks me up every year at the Masters, because all we talk about is wind. That property is so unique in the hills and the valleys and that it holds, that a 5 mile an hour, 7 mile an hour breath of wind, which is wind in Augusta, makes a difference, right? And if it gets to 10 or more, it's a shit show out there. only on that property. If you go to Washington Road, if you go to another golf course, if you go my golf course, like, no wind ever. And then that week it's there. So if there's a little bit of wind, or if the flag is, if there's a little to no wind, or flag is middle or left, it's a birdie hole. If the flag is right, it's a lot more difficult. And if there's any wind at all, trying to figure it out is hard. A lot of people don't realize that if you hit it too high over the trees that are behind that green, mm-hmm. then the wind that's coming from that direction hits your ball. Mm-hmm. If you can flight it low enough under those trees, it doesn't affect it as much. The problem is that green is it's not deep. It's very, you know, it's not a deep situation back there. Now, you right. can kind of roll it off the back in places, but it's just a great hole. I mean, I agree with you. I think my favorite hole to watch typically has been 13, but it might be different this year with the tee box being moved back. I'm already hearing
how far they move it back. I've not done my Masters research. The big guy's been busy with other shit.
60 to 75 yards.
Ooh, so the second's going to – that's not basically if you hit a good drive, it's a free birdie now, right? It's not going to be the case any longer.
Not at all. So we talked to – JT Poston is a friend of ours. He's playing in a second Masters. He just did a little reconnaissance trip up there a couple of weeks ago. Played with Jeff Knox, who is the famous marker, the member that's the best player that will play if there's an odd number mm-hmm. of players on the weekend. He's now retired as the marker. There's a new guy this year, but he played with Jeff Knox, and I was asking about that tee, and it seems like the consensus is now it's going to be driver for everybody, because what used to happen is a lot of guys would hit 3 wood off that tee so they could turn it over mm-hmm. and get around the corner. Yeah. There were few that went driver over the trees. But now it looks like everybody's hitting driver, and unless you can hit a late draw, you're probably just trying to hit a straight ball right. down that fairway. But now you're going to have a longer irons into that green, which is going to be testy mm-hmm. To hold those greens in certain pin positions to get it close. You know, obviously there's more risk reward too with that creek. That the thing I love about 13 is that second shot. It always, you know, you look at it on paper and it the distance, and it doesn't look hard, but that creek just continually gets closer and closer to, like,
doesn't that whole fairway runs down to the left, down to the creek, right? Like, it's a right to left fairway, so you're not going to get a flat lie either, right? The ball's almost certainly going to be above your feet,
right? You don't get a flat lie, and the further you miss to the right on the second shot, the more creek is in play, and it's just crazy to me how that small creek, it's not that big, swallows up so many balls every year with guys with irons in hand. It's not like they're hitting 5 woods into the green. You know, they're hitting irons, and it just continues to eat up balls. It'll be cool to see how they do it this year.
And some guys, I mean, it's just going to be natural that if you're taking driver on 13, that creek all down the left is going to be a real thing. Or I think more than anything, people are going to be putting in those trees over to the right, then you have no shot at the green from there. You're just punching down and trying to get up and down for birdie from like 100 yards if that's the case. So it sounds like to me 13, which I think, I don't know, I'd have to check the math. I would assume has been the easiest hole on the course as far as scoring average. That will not be the case this year.
I don't know. It might be 13 or 2.
Yeah, 2. Yeah, those would be the two that I would think of, 13 or 2. All right, so and then let's see if there's any other holes I wanted to talk about in particular. I also really like 15, especially when they can get clever. I'm a big fan of par fives, you can't tell. But I feel like that hole is really dependent on where they put the flag. You know, like that hole seems a lot more gettable sometimes when they have it in the right spots. And sometimes they put that flag where, like, if you get a par, it's like, kudos to you, sir. Kudos to you.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of those where, like, if you go long on that green, you're just like, your asshole's clenched so tight.
Exactly.
15 is fun. I tell you a hole that, let me ask you this. So what would you say if you had to pick two holes that you're sweating your lineups, or you're sweating a ticket on? What are the two holes that you're just like, pray to God your guy gets a par on?
Oh, I mean, every time I, you know, like, I have a guy that's in contention, 18, it's going in the fucking trees every time. I don't know what it is about that tee shot. Like, if my guy has a bogey-free round, it's going to be in the trees, he's punching out, and they never get up and down from 100 yards on 18. I don't know what the fuck it is about that hole. Maybe it's the layer greens, but anytime I see my guy hitting his third shot from 100 yards out because he had a punch out of the trees, never going to happen. I swear I've lost so many bogey-free rounds to freaking 18. It looks like a normal hole, but for whatever reason, maybe it's the length, maybe it's the trees, maybe it's the last hole today. I don't know what it is, but I'll tell you this. I've had that hole triggers my ass more than any hole because I've lost so many good rounds to that fucking 18th hole, that 18th green or 18th hole. What about 18?
Yeah, 18 is scary for sure. I mean, the tee shot is when, you know, if you get past the tee shot, you can kind of go, you know.
Yeah. Now, if you're talking about me personally, all the fucking shots would be intimidating. I'm talking about,
like sweating a lineup, but
yeah,
18, that tee shot is scary. But for me, the two holes that I think everybody's the most afraid of is 5 and 11. Mm-hmm. 5 is an underrated bitch of a hole. I mean, it is a 500-yard par 4 that now the bunkers are basically a one-shot penalty. You can be OB right. You can be in the trees right. If you don't hit driver because you're trying to take bunker out of play, then you're probably hitting 3-wood, 5-wood, you know, into a par 4. That green, it's also like, you know, a lot of long par 4s, you might see an easier green,
right.
a green that, you know, what that green is one of the most undulating greens on the whole golf course. There's bunkers, two bunkers in play there. Like that hole is brutal to me. So every time my guys are having, you know, got it going or something, and they get to 5, I'm just like, pray to God that we get a par. And then at 11, you're sweating it too, and they made that one harder last year by moving the tee back. So those are the two, like, hold on tight, like, just give me a par.
The second shot is the start of Amen Quarter, right? I want to make sure I got my – it's the second shot on 11, the tee shot on 12, and then the tee on 13. That's the Amen Corner, right?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people just consider those three holes.
But, okay.
You know, 12 is the corner, right? Yeah. Or now it's kind of 13T is the corner because they moved it back so far. I mean, when those guys walk off at 12 green this year, they're going to take a 90-degree left and go way back.
Yeah.
You know, it's back there. But yeah, that you're holding on there for sure.
All right. So this is the first time that we're going to have the real drama of the LIV guys being back.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of layers to this onion to talk about. So first of all, are you happy that the LIV guys are back? Because I sure as shit am. I want to see the best golfers at the fucking majors. Okay, I don't 100%. Really, you know, them leaving the PGA and me playing PGA DFS. You want to know the truth? Hadn't fucking affected me at all. But
yeah.
I want them to be at the majors. I do. I especially because it adds a whole nother level of strategy to it.
Yeah.
So what are your feelings about the LIV guys being back? Should they be allowed at the majors? What do you think about their, like, you know, are they going to continue to qualify as their world golf rankings drop? What do you think about all this?
Yeah, 100%, man. I know we talked about LIV last time I was on. I think they should be. I'm glad they are. I'm with you. A lot of these guys, like, I miss a lot of these guys. I really do. Not necessarily from like a I'm still playing the same amount of DFS and betting and doing all that stuff, but I do miss watching some of them. I miss the drama of some of it. I miss the handicapping of them. I was a huge Joaquin Neiman guy. I was always playing freaking Joaquin Neiman, and he did well for me. So I miss a lot of these guys, and I'm really excited to see them next week. I'm excited to see the whole thing. Like, you know, you and me, I mean, if it's the more drama, the better for what we do. So
I'll tell you this. The LIV didn't take all the best players, but they took all the best characters. I mean, like, you, like, Bryson is a great character. Brooks, I think, is a dumbass, but the guy's a great character. You know, Patrick Reed, the ultimate villain. I mean, they just took so many. I mean, Dustin's just, you know, he's a big dumb animal. I love him, but he's a big dumb animal, and I miss having him around, just hearing his goofy interviews, not even understanding what the question is. They just took so many of the best characters.
Garcia's a character.
Cam Smith.
Bubba's a character. Cam Smith. HV3 is a guy, you know. There's so many interesting. Dude, I'm just looking at my list here. I mean, even Kevin Na, like him or what? He's a weird dude. Like, he stands out about a few things about his game on and off the course.
And let's be real. Look at the guys that are left: Scottie Scheffler, John Rahm, Patrick Cantlay, Xander Schauffele. I'm sorry, those guys are amazing golfers. They're boring as fuck. All of them. All okay, John Rahm gets upset occasionally, but outside of that, he has no personality.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely, and I, you know, I don't think a lot of these guys are boring people, but they're so high up there, and they're so stinking wealthy, and they've got so many damn sponsor deals, and they're so protective of their personal brand that we're not going to get let into any of that.
Like, sir, Patrick Cantlay is boring as fuck.
I've actually heard Cantlay is a good time.
Is he? Okay.
But he's so good.
He's got that image on the course.
He's so good at just being this publicly. Luke List is a friend of ours, and he plays out at my club, Champions. He lives here in Augusta, and his home course is my course. And one of his good friends is Patrick Cantlay. Mm. So I've heard some good stories about Cantlay off the course.
In Cantlay's defense, there was the hot mic where he called all the guys pampered fucks. Yeah. And I was like, my man, I need more of this. I need more slandering of other players on the tour. And what he said was exactly right. They were being pampered fucks, and it needed to be called out. But, watching him play is like, I think I'd rather take a swift kick to the nuts from a donkey than watch Patrick Cantlay stand over a putt or any shot. It's infuriating.
He needs to speed up his he does need to speed up.
Don't get me started on pace of play. Like, whatever. I don't want to go down that road. All right. So, live, guys.
Yeah.
Motivation-wise, like, I think I think it's pretty clear there's going to be a narrative out there this week that they're highly motivated to come in and make a name for themselves, because I think they learned a very valuable lesson in life, and one that everybody could stand to learn is, like, you think that you're more important than you are. And I think a lot of these guys going over, they thought, oh, well, people will follow us because, I'm such a great golfer and I've won all these tournaments and majors, blah, blah, blah. And to be honest, the live, people watching the live is fucking laughable. It's like, no one watches it. When you look at how many good players they have versus the number of people watch, it just shows that people don't like to go outside of what they already know. And people know the PGA, and that's what they're going to continue to watch. They don't particularly care who the players are. So I think these guys have some hurt pride, and I think that's going to motivate them to come out there and say, you remember me, motherfather? And so you buying that narrative for the Masters?
I think you're spot on with that. I was way more – I think I talked about this with Joe Idoni a couple weeks ago. I was way more bullish on Liv's future coming out of their finals event in Miami in October I went to, and then like November. And then it just feels like everything came to a screeching halt. And it feels like their first event didn't pop off like they needed it to or they wanted it to. It feels like the second event was worse. I think this week's event is going to be even worse. I feel like they've lost all momentum that they may have had. And we'll see what that means long term. But I do agree that these guys, I mean, first of all, like, they need to play well, because I mean, for Cam Smith and like DJ, maybe they can kind of slack off another year. But for most of these dudes, if you don't want to go play in Singapore, in a few weeks, you need to have a good week and get some world ranking points for sure. You want to prove that, hey, everybody's saying that we're washed up, we're playing on a development, an exhibition tour, and the competition's bullshit, and we got the money and we don't care anymore. All that's bullshit, because look, we're out here kicking ass. I totally buy into that. We talked to Benji Thompson, who's the caddy for Abe Anser. He's been on the PGA, he was a caddy on the PGA tour for years before Abe. He's had Abe for a couple years. He was a caddy for Lexi Thompson back in the day. Benji's from Augusta, lives in Augusta. And Benji said, the one benefit that Abe has seen going to live is he's had more time to practice. Mm-hmm. He's like, on the PGA Tour schedule, we would be playing so many events, if you're Abe Anser, that when he was home on an off week, he was resting. And now he's actually, he's not had to go out and play a whole lot of Singapore events or Thailand events or whatever on the Asian Tour. But, he's like, now he's actually had a chance to work on a few things and change a few things and practice like he's never practiced before. And I think that's going to help him at Augusta. We'll see if that's true for everybody or what, but I do think that we're going to have some live players pop. I haven't finished figuring out who those guys are. I'd be interested to hear who you think, like, who's your eyeball, what does your eyeballs tell you?
I'll tell you the first thing you're going to do, because we're both some sweaty DFS guys. In that world, I think you got to be having a good amount of live guys in your player pool, because you're going to inherently get them under own, because they're not going to pop in people's models, because they're not going to have any fucking strokes gain data for them. They haven't seen them forever. They forgot they existed. And, people, I honestly, you want to know something? I bet there's 5-10% of people out there that hold a grudge against them and won't play them because they make, they make these decisions with their heart instead of their brain.
And Augusta's the place, right? Like, Augusta's the place where you don't have to have, form is definitely, you're not going to win if you're not in good form. But we see it all the time. Old farts, guys that just have played have a record at Augusta but are coming in with not the best form can easily eke out a top 20.
Right.
And I mean, you might not take down the tournament with a guy top 20, but you're going to do pretty freaking good. And so I look at a guy like let's, you know, look at Patrick Reed. Okay. Mm. Patrick Reed, he's played two events on LIV this year. I don't know what the results are from Orlando yet. They just teed off. He's finished 38th and 18th out of a 48 man field. You would look at that and be like, that's probably not very good.
Yep.
But it's Augusta, right? Mm-hmm. So the whole course history thing for me goes way up. Yep. And, you know, I can kind of go, well,
never forget the year that Patrick Reed won. He was 6% owned on DK that week. So don't think that he, you know, when everybody's off Patrick Reed, he can't come smash here.
Yeah.
What is it about the Masters, Augusta specifically, that leads to such sticky course history? Of all the places, this is the number one course, and I don't think this is some hot take. I think a lot of people know this, that you play course history at the Masters. Why is course history so sticky around here? Is it just guys like fucking focus around it? I can't pinpoint it. I would love to know what makes the course history so sticky. Is it because it's such a condensed field, so there's only so many guys that can do well? Maybe that's part of the answer.
I think all of that's probably part of it. I think I obviously being the place, we have a large sample size, right? It's a place where the best players in the world continue to come year after year. So you have sample size to look at as one. But you know, if you listen to guys' interviews over the years, or you talk to players over the years, it does seem that there are just things, subtleties that you learn year after year that save you whatever it may be. A quarter of a stroke, right? Like, and those little things can add up to a stroke or two over a 5-year, 6-year, 7-year career at Augusta. And a lot of that has to do with places that you miss, places you can't miss. It has to do with lines and sight lines and knowing, okay, if the pin is back right on 12 and that wind is 6 miles an hour, we are not going for that flag. It's tempting. I want to cut it in there. It's an 8-iron. It's a 9-iron. I want to cut it. I can cut it in there, but we're not doing it. It doesn't pay off. We're going center of the green or right center of that front bunker, and we're done. Like, learning those little things over the years and having those notes probably helps. Obviously, the greens are complex, and the green reading subtleties are there. But I don't know.
Yeah. And a good rule is, it seems like the good players tend to play well there. That kind of makes the course history sticky.
Well, I think you said what you said, like they all want to show up and play well, right? Yeah.
It's the biggest event of the year. Right. I love the U.S. Open.
It's a major. They all want to win.
Exactly right. I mean, you get to go forever. You get to be that old fart wearing the suspenders. All right. Is Tiger officially committed to playing in the Masters yet?
Yeah, I think he's committed. I mean, he's not.
He hadn't said anything that, like, injury updates, like I might not play or anything like that.
No, he's on the. I mean, I'm looking on the Masters site now. He's listed as a player. Okay, so.
I'm so bad at PGA news. I'm going to be bummed if he doesn't play.
Oh yeah, me too.
Hey, so you said they added length to 13. Did they add length anywhere else? Because I got to think at this point in his career, length is going to hurt him. The longer a course is, the less it plays into his ability. It still seems like second shot in, Tiger is still, you know, good enough to win PGA Tours. Yeah. I just worry a little bit about, you know, him being 320 off the tee anymore. He can give JT all the tampons he wants, but, you know, that I don't think that's normal that he bombs it that far.
I don't think so. I think 13's the biggest. Last year it was 11. They did some stuff to 11, or they changed the fairway in 11. Over the last couple of years, they've gradually added length to 5. So I don't think so. I think the biggest one is 13.
So he still might be able to get around the course.
Dude, I think Tiger is still plenty long.
Yeah.
I mean, I noticed it at the match when we watched that match exhibition. I only watched like 5 holes, but you know, I was watching the match and I was like, damn, he's right there with JT. I mean, you know, Rory was a little beyond him, but he's right there with JT. And then to watch him play Riv, I mean, I thought he was consistently out there, right? In terms of distance. So I think Tiger's in play for Augusta. I don't think he's in play. I mean, I don't know that I'll play a lot of him, but what? I think he makes the cut.
How long until they just realize that Tiger is kind of a god among men in the PGA lexicon and just let him have a fucking cart? I think he could still beat these guys if he didn't have to take the wear and tear of walking 18 4 days in a row.
I don't think Tiger would do it if they said they'd let him.
Too prideful.
Yep.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's a good answer. That's a very good answer.
The ego on that dude is through the roof.
I don't know why. Very yeah. few accomplishments by that man.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think we got to conclude the master stock with this one. Who's going to win and why?
All right. I'm going to tell you the guy that I did a lot of research on yesterday, and I had a little hot tip on from a source yesterday that will be a hot topic in a lot of my content. And it's not Scottie Scheffler, John Rahm, Roy McIlroy, whatever. We don't need those guys. Scottie's probably going to win, right?
hey,
but my guy is Tony Finau.
Oh.
Yeah.
Assuming he doesn't snap his ankle in half again and then pop it back into place on the par three.
I think he learned his lesson. I don't think we'll see Tony.
that's still the craziest video that people don't talk about enough. He re-popped his ankle into place and then played all weekend.
And then finished like 20th or something.
He finished 10th.
Is that the year he finished 10th?
Yes, it was unbelievable. Well, like, and his ankle was like that big from, you know, it's not good when you pop your ankle back into place. All right, continue. Tell me about Tony.
The number one thing, so first of all, he's in year like 7 or 8. Mm-hmm. Which if you look at trends, he's 33 years old. He's in year 7 or 8. If you look at trends at Augusta, you tend to get older, more experienced winners. He's obviously been hot. I mean, he's been very hot. Now, his last 4 tournaments, has he been in contention? Not really, but, you know, long-term or recent, you know, however you define recent-term success, whatever. Last 6 months, last year, he's been hot. Augusta suits him so, so well. And to me, the number one thing at Augusta National is from 175 and out. 175 to 225, you have got to be on your damn game. So if you're playing a guy who is a short knocker off the tee, he better – Tom Kim, Abe Anser, like those guys, like good long iron players. You know, Abe Anser's got like a surprisingly good record here, and it's because he's a good long iron player.
Yep.
You have got to be really damn good from 175 to 225 at Augusta. And that's what Tony's one of the best in the world at that, with an underrated short game, a very good putter. He's putted well at Augusta. I think I looked at it yesterday. In the last 2 years at Augusta, so I'm excluding the 2020 situation, but the last 2 years at Augusta, he's been positive strokes gained 6 out of the last 8 rounds with the putter, which is key for him.
No doubt.
So to me, I think Tony Finau could get it done. A guy like that, level headed, isn't going to lose his cool, isn't going to, you know, be mad at the golf course. It's why Tyrrell Hatton's never going to win Augusta. Like,
it's easy to be accurate from 175 to 225 for Tony when he's hitting like a fucking 8 iron.
Yeah, an 8 iron.
Exactly. that's so crazy.
Which is why distance is a thing, right?
Right.
Like that's why it's less about the off the tee. It's less about having the distance off the tee, and it's more about those, what irons are you hitting into these freaking greens.
All right.
So to me, my dark horse is Finau.
All right. What do you know his DraftKings salary off the top of your head? Because it's something.
He's 8,900.
That's actually about where he should be. Yeah. I think that's not going to make him super chalky. I thought they might, you know, do that stupid shit where they make Tony Finau 8,000. It's like, okay, well, there's your plug and play guy.
Yeah, I mean, typically it's the same typical soft major championship match.
But 8,900 is not ridiculously soft for Finau at a major. All right, so I made this mistake, what was that, four or five years ago, right? Brooks Koepka, when he kept winning the PGA, kept winning the U.S. Open, every time I'd be like, he can't keep doing it. He can't keep doing this. And I just believe that. And then last year, when Scotty was on his run, I was like, he can't keep doing this. He can't keep doing this. And this year I've said, fuck it, I'm not doing it again. I knew Scotty was going to win the Waste Management. I knew Scotty was going to win the match play. He didn't, but he still killed it. He still played great. And now I know he's going to win the Masters, and I just refuse to just say he can't do it, because he's gonna fucking do it. I will find a way to eat the chalk and be different in other ways. Scottie Scheffler's gonna win. I've learned my lesson from Brooks' trauma. Brooks hurt me financially and emotionally, and I'm not gonna let Scottie do it to me in 2023. I've been riding that Scottie train, and I'll fucking ride it till the wheels fall off.
He looks just as good as he looked last year. Like, I mean, he just and now he's got another year of experience, more wins. The guy is just he's unreal right now. You know, he's coming in to a time when Rahm is also really, really good right now and bucking his head, and I think ready to win at Augusta too. But I'm with you. Like, if you had a pistol on my brain right now, and you wanted me to pick one, I'm gonna Scottie Scheffler. You know, like
Here's the one thing about Scottie Scheffler, and this may be a terrible take, but all I can do is just tell you my perception. I cannot tell you why he is so good. Like, no part of his game just seems like he's the number one player in the world at that thing. Like, when I think of Rory, you know, just an elite ball striker, right? When, you know, like Dustin, when he was so good, that cut off the tee was just so unfair what he could do. He could hit it further and straighter than anybody. But with Scottie Scheffler, the only thing I've came up with is he's only behind Jordan Spieth in this category. Strokes game magic means. That guy, he's just a magical dude. If it's 26 feet to save par, it's going in the cup, right? If he has an impossible lie, he'll find a way to get it up greenside, get up and down and save par. He is just unbelievably creative. And no part of his game, no in particular part of his game, it makes me just think super elite. It's just the sum of the parts are greater than any one part. And
everything is so good to me. Everything is good. And that's from, okay, but that's more than the strokes gain categories, right? Because strokes gain categories, sure. Off tee approach, around the green putting, awesome. Don't forget, world-class caddy, world-class mental game, strokes gain home life.
Yeah.
All of those things add up to a hell of a lot for a guy. And you'd be shocked how many guys on the PGA Tour don't have that shit, right? You know, we talk about it all the time with players and caddies we know, like strokes gain home life. You know why Kiz is really being bad right now? Like Kevin Kisner isn't great?
I would love to hear it.
It could be the Wilson deal, the new equipment change. Okay, sure. It could be the coaching carousel that he's on right now. But you know what I think it is? His wife made him quit dipping.
Back in June. Yep.
And dude, I mean, I love kids, but these guys are creatures of habit. They're creatures of habit. Some of them have, you know, their OCD tendencies that are, or, you know, I got to have it this way or this is how I've always done it. Kiz has been playing golf with a dip in his mouth since he was a teenager.
Right. Big old dip, too.
Never played a round of golf without it.
So, Strokes gain psychology is the most underrated thing in PGA. This is why course history is a real thing, because a guy can be playing like shit and he shows up to a course where he has good feels and he does well. You know, putting splits, you know, this guy putts well in Bermuda, this guy putts well on Poa. A lot of people are like, that's all arbitrary. But I'm telling you, if they think they're going to putt well because they're on this surface and that makes them have positive thoughts standing over the ball, that's where the real edge at greens come in. I don't think that they magically are a better putter on this surface than this surface on any given day, but when they're in their good mindset, they are. And that would bring me right back to Scottie Scheffler. I think strokes gain psychology, he's dealt with what it feels like to be just the number one player in the world, to be on an incredible heater, and now that he's won a major and he's been the number one player with all the spotlight for a year, I think he's had to have at least gotten used to it. He may not love it, but he knows how to manage it and deal with it. And I think that, like, this is just going to be an incredible run for him. I don't think he'll taper off after the Masters like he did last year.
I don't think so either, man. It's a train coming. I'm like you. I've been sitting there looking at him going, all right, well, I'm going to be the chalk donkey, as you like to say. I'll be the chalk donkey on Scotty, and we'll figure it out.
Give me all the chalk donkey. I'll play him in 100% of my lineups. I don't give a fuck. He's going to win. He's going
to do some Scotty and live stacks, and then we'll be good. Hey. We'll have plenty of ownership leverage.
Exactly. That's right. Just Scotty and all the live guys. Scotty and the lives. It sounds like a band from the 70s.
So you said you haven't done a whole lot of Masters research. Let me ask you this. What do you think of Leishman and Paul Casey this year?
Okay, first of all, they're in the field?
Okay, that was the trick question.
Okay. I was going to say, I didn't think they were in there.
I was doing the research. I was doing the early research a week or so ago, and I was like, wait a minute. And I was looking at all the live guys in the field, and I was like, how did Mark Leishman and Paul Casey not get in the field? That is so crazy to me. Those two guys have been staples at Augusta for years, and both have played Augusta very well. They, you know, Casey's been the chalk donkey for the last like 6 years at Augusta.
He's always underpriced.
He's only $7,800.
Exactly right.
And you know he's not going to win, but that sucker in the top five.
Yep.
And then Leishman's been solid, and I was like, holy crap, we're not going to have I guarantee you, man. Those guys, those two guys, you take all that money, right? And it feels good. And it hits your bank account last year. It feels damn good. I'm sure it does. But I guarantee you this week, those boys are at home going, shit.
Remorse and regret this week.
This sucks. Right. I could not believe they were not in the field. The other day I was on the phone with Pat, and I was like, hey, what do you think? You think Leishman and Casey would be a good play? He's like, yeah, dude, Casey, you kidding? Leishman's sneaky good. I was like, yeah, guess what? Neither one of them are going to be playing.
Only reason I knew that is because me and you are both doing some best ball over there on Underdog, and I was trying to research who's qualified for all four majors, you know, give all my followers a good tool, because you don't want to be drafting guys that are only going to play in two majors, right?
Right.
And I was like, where the fuck is Paul Casey and Mark Leishman, right? Like, these are good players. And the problem with these LIV guys is if they're not going and playing in some of these other tours and getting points, they're just free-falling. And Leishman and Paul Casey were not in great form. They hadn't accumulated a lot of OWGR points before leaving for the LIV. So now they've just fallen off a map. And I don't see any way they get back, especially now it's a brutal cycle because they're not going to get in the majors, the one place they could accrue some nice points. And it's just going to be, it's going to be a snowball of them getting fucked on these things forever now. Once again, I think it was a very short-sighted thing. I get money, but like I got to assume Paul Casey was so rich that he was not going to ever be in need. I cannot believe more of these guys did not factor in legacy over money. Especially the truly rich ones. I get like HV3 wanting to build some generational wealth because maybe he wouldn't have been able to do that on the PGA. Some of these older guys taking the bag, you know, Ian Poulter, smart move. But some of these guys that still had real years left to compete in majors, I think it was a very short-sighted decision. But, you know, it's their life. They'll have to live with it. You know,
The Masters is going to be the tournament that stings the most because, like I've already said, it's the major they all want to win because of what comes with it for the rest of your life after. You know, USGA, I mean, or US Open, or like, do you know who won the US Open in 1994? No, like,
not a chance.
Don't care. And guess what? That person probably, their life didn't end up a whole lot different for having done so.
Right.
But, you know, you miss out on the Masters and you possibly never come back again. And you never get that chance at a tournament where older guys tend to can win. You know, I mean, it's obviously a youth dominated game. And we've seen that with Scheffler here. But the old farts every now and then, the Garcias and the, you know, those guys can pop up and win.
Will the PGA take back these LIV guys if they come crawling back? And if that happens, who do you think's the first defector to come back and be like, I'm sorry, baby, take me back?
Golly, man. Boy, I don't know. I don't know if the PGA Tour will take him back. If Jay Monahan is not commissioner, I would say yes. If he is, I don't know. I think it depends on who it is. It depends on how they say how they want to come. I don't know. I think if they do take him back, they will take them back with serious penalty. Like, could you imagine? What if Brooks was like, "Hey guys, I really do want back," and Monahan was like, "Cool, here's your Korn Ferry Tour card."
Mm. I mean, I would like the cut of his jib if he did that.
Can you imagine that? Like, that would be...
And there's no way Brooks would ever do that. He would never go play his way back on. He would want to be reestablished exactly where he was and get all of his, you know, all of his status reinstated.
I think if I was a LIV guy wanting to defect, I would want to get a group of guys. I would not want to go in
solo
to the you know, I don't want to go tail tuck to the principal's office by myself. I want to grab some boys and be like, listen, we all want to come back. You know, the four of us, the five, whatever, we all want to come back. It's going to put a major dent in LIV situation. We're willing to, you know, do the whole tuck your tail public apology tour. That would be interesting.
Here's the problem. I already tell you the problem. Almost all these guys that left are like very individual type dudes, right? They're not the kind of guys that are going to go form a little union to come back. And so I mean, when I think of some of the most individualistic players, it's literally everybody that left for LIV, right? Like Brooks, Bryson, Patrick Reed, even Cam Smith is just like, you know, he's his own dude. It's not going to happen. All right.
But you know, if like Matt Wolf and, like if Wolf and Taylor Gooch and HV3 and I don't know, you know, Abe Anser, all came and said, "Hey, we're on the younger side. We realized we left and we didn't cherish the legacy long enough. We want to be in these majors for the rest of, you know, for a long career." Like, you know, we'll see.
There's got to be a chance that LIV. I know everybody talks about LIV has unlimited money. Mother father, nobody has unlimited money when you're losing it every year. Every person who has money at some point will say, I'm not going to continue to blow money on this every year and lose money. So I could see a path to which LIV just dries up in the next 2 to 3 years. Okay, I know they have money to continue to pay these guys, but at some point they're not going to continue to eat. I don't know. Let's just say they're losing $100 million a year. I'm pulling that number out of my ass. But they're not just going to eat that in perpetuity. They're not going to do that forever. So like, I think there is a path that a lot of these guys are going to get back there when LIV fails, or they see the writing on the wall that LIV is going to fail. They tuck tail and come back to the PGA.
I mean, if they lost $100 million a year, that'd be a huge victory because, right. I mean, they spent $2 billion last year and they're spending $2 billion this year. And you're already seeing the straps tighten. You're already seeing daddy, you know, daddy, you know, coming in your room saying, all right, boy, you're a young man now. Like, your ass is going to do this, this, and this. Mm-hmm. I'm not paying for your private jets. I'm not paying for your accommodations. Your team's going to do it. You're going to kick back here. You're going to make these appearances here. You're not taking your uniform off if you're in public or on another golf. You're already seeing stuff tighten up. But then if they do that and then no one still watches.
Yep.
And no one sponsors the teams. And no one, no one buys the apparel. It's going to stop. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it doesn't matter if you have unlimited money.
What'll be fascinating is if one of these LIV guys, let's say Cam Smith wins the Masters, what will be really fascinating about that is to see, does that lead to a boost in LIV? And I'm going to go ahead and tell you the answer. It won't. Like, I'm the perfect example of the kind of people they need to be interested in LIV, right? Above average golf fans, you know, I'm into the PGA. I should be interested in the LIV. And honest to God, I don't even know week to week that they have events. Like, it's not even on my radar. I couldn't tell you who won. I couldn't tell you where they're playing. I couldn't tell you anything. And if I know that little, imagine what a casual feels about it.
Yeah. 100%, man. It's not been good.
To me, their upside is like college golf, right? College golf is really good. But you got to be a hardo to be into college golf, right?
For sure.
And like that's like their upside. Only the hardos that really love some golf are ever going to be into it. They're not going to get casual fans. There's just not casual golf fans out there going to watch it. That's my take, Bob. That's my take.
Yeah.
All right. Last thing. Let's talk a little bit about you and the Tour Junkies. So first of all, I didn't realize this until the other day. I know you've been full time doing PGA content for a while, which is no small accomplishment in life. Because for many years you had a normal job and were doing Tour Junkies as like, you know, like you were moonlighting as a content creator, right?
Yeah. For seven. We started Tour Junkies in 2015.
Yep.
And I had a full time job until March 1st of 2022. Wow. So I just came on my 1 year anniversary of being completely full time TJ.
Are you enjoying it? Is it all you thought it would be?
I am enjoying it, man. I think, there's been a couple of moments in the last year that have been really challenging, and I've maybe vocalized something on a show or something. I got people in my DMs going, "What an asshole, man! You fucking cover golf for a life, and how could you say that?" I understand how that may sound to some people, but it's been hard. It's been a grind. It's been different. There are definitely advantages that I've really, really enjoyed. I actually don't play any more golf than I used to. I played once a week back when I had a job in Tour Junkies. I was like, oh, sweet. When I have Tour Junkies, I'm going to play 2-3 times a week. No, I still play once a week because now everything's falling on me. All my income is on me. Mm-hmm. And so on a Thursday or Friday when I want to kick off and go to the golf course, I'm like, well, I got this to do. And I got to catch up on this. And if I don't do this or I don't prep for the show next week, and I'm going to be doing it on the weekend, I can't do that. So, you know, I'm playing once a week still. Right. But it is great, man. It's the dream. And I'm hoping to keep doing it. But
I guess the one thing you got going for you is you probably fucking love enjoy doing it, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
It doesn't feel like work, so to speak, other than the time commitment, right? But while you're doing it, you're not like, I hate this, like a fucking accountant is looking at numbers for 8 straight hours every day.
No, it's so weird. I mean, I love handicapping the Valero, right? Like, I really do love it. I love this kind of stuff. I love being on camera or being on a podcast or being in the Discord. So it's all the other stuff that you're just like, oh, this does feel like a job, but yeah, dude, I 100% am loving it.
So tell me, Pat's not full time though, right? For all of you that don't know, new guy, Pat's his partner in crime over there, right? So yeah. Pat is not full time. Why is he not full time, and will that ever happen?
Yeah, I really hope it happens if that's the goal. He's not full time because we need to make more money. So, the thing about it is we started in 2015 when podcasts were not a thing anywhere. I'm not talking about just golf podcasts. Like, no one was listening to podcasts anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's when we started, which I'm grateful for because that's built that, you know, those first few years when we were new is what built our base and helped us get to where we are. But even when we started, I had 3 kids. I was married. Pat had 2 kids. He was married. You know, it's like, we can only do so much. Like, hey, babe, I'm going to go upstairs every Monday night and talk to my buddy on the, you know, and record it. And nobody's going to listen to it for the first year. It's hard to do. So if we were 25 when we started it and right out of college and no kids and no responsibilities, we'd have both been full-time a long time ago. But you know, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners would know, like, if you got a family, you can't just, you know, it's hard to just go from making this and having a lifestyle of this to going, hey, I'm 40. I'm almost 40. Pat's just turned 46. He's an old fart. Like, right. We're about to be irrelevant in the space.
Right.
You can't just be at 46 and go like, hey, I'm going to go from making this to making this now with two kids, you know, one in middle school, one in high school, and a wife.
Right.
Well, the one thing I would say you guys have going for you, that you started from the beginning. And because you started from the beginning, you've had longer to build up an audience, and you've built, like, a very loyal crowd. And let me just tell you, as a guy who has not been in the space for even a year, it is very hard to build an audience. You know, I like this is why I never take it for granted. Every subscriber I get, you know, even to my YouTube, I'm so thankful for every one of them, because I see so many guys doing such great content out there, and it's so hard to find an audience now, because so many people are already loyal to the people they've been listening to. Unless you're doing something very different, or you're providing, you know, some content in a way that nobody's ever heard it, it's almost impossible to gain an audience now. It is a super saturated market, and you know, that's why, like, anybody that can do it full time, I just always want to give them a tip of the cap. Because that shit's impressive. There's not a ton of money in this industry, and it's a ton of work. But if you love it, you can get away with it and justify it.
Yeah, and thanks for saying that, man. And dude, mad props to you. I've been saying it for years. I've been saying I can't imagine starting something now because of how competitive it is. Like, we had it easy because we started it first, or we were, you know, we were like the second after Pat Mayo. Mm-hmm. But you know. Your YouTube growth and your audience growth is super impressive at the rate that you've done it in a space this competitive. And I think it's because you're really good at it. Like, you're good and you're sharp at the information, and you understand the game theory, and you understand the game, and you're a winner yourself. And then you're also entertaining to watch and listen to. So that is unique in a lot of ways, just right there. But you're 100% right. You have to have, I can't imagine starting it right now, unless I was 23 right out of college and was like, well, you know, I'll just dick around and make 25 grand for a couple years and see if I can turn it into something. Right.
And I appreciate you saying those things, but the real answer is even though I may provide some things differently, and I've, you know, I can fall back on being a successful player for many years, like, I've been very lucky, like, just the timing of everything, having some good connections that retweeted my show early. Shout out Andy. Thank you. You know, going to the PGA Championship literally that second week that I had it, and then being able to come back and do a video with, like, live from the course, because it was here in Oklahoma. It was just really good timing. Nobody was covering Showdown. I can't that had an audience, and I just kind of found this perfect little world to go exist in. And you know, just so correlated with people getting more and more interested in PGA Showdown. A lot of luck. A lot of luck is the answer.
Yeah. But you're doing a great job with it, man, and you have to be lucky. Like, dude, I mean, I don't think anybody's in any industry at any level of success and can't look back at some really lucky moments, right?
Yep.
We have definitely had lucky moments.
I see some people making PGA DFS content right now, and I check them out every week, because I'm like, these guys do great work. And the guy, you know, like, I'm not trying to shit on them, but, like, they'll get, like, maybe 100 views, right? That's, like, a good week for them. Like, this is really good stuff. And it's not because it's not great. It's just they haven't found that audience yet, because, as you've said, the market is so saturated, and it's so tough to find a footing.
Yep, it's a grind. So all right. It's hard to keep doing that and then only see 100 people watching, right?
So me and you, we're both doing some underdog best ball, right?
Yeah.
All right. I'm in. All of you need to go check it out. You have already a YouTube video over it. I have a YouTube video over it. We're selling it hard. It is fun. If you play best ball football, how the fuck could you, and you love PGA, how could you not play PGA best ball? I'll never get it. I'm going to go spam 150 lineups this weekend because I'm a try hard.
I don't know that I have 150, but I'll have plenty.
Sir, you're a responsible adult, okay? My name is literally Degenerate 75. I have a reputation to live up to.
That's true.
All right, my man, I really appreciate your time. Why don't you tell these lovely folks where they can find you? I got to assume most of these people know you, but for the few of them that may not, tell them where they can find you, your content, what you're about, and everything they need to know about you.
Obviously, anywhere you listen to podcasts, and then the Tour Junkies YouTube channel put out a lot of all the podcasts go up on the YouTube as well. And then there's some unique content that ends up on the YouTube channel, like that best ball video I did. And then other than that, it's Instagram and Twitter at @Tour_Junkies. Our Discord is a great place to be if you're into Discord. We've got a free version that kind of lets you look around and lightly get involved. But then a paid version as well. I think our Discord community is some of the best there are. They're a bunch of degenerate, loving golf, sport, betting, DFS, loving people. We got channels for every sport in there, although it's primarily golf. And that's where a lot of our exclusive content, some of the things that we learn every week from on site go into there. So it's a good spot to be.
I know a ton of my members are also members over at Tour Junkies, and I think in this day and age, if you're trying to play DFS competitively, you need to be in a good Discord and hear stuff, because everybody has little tidbits of information that you could never find on your own on Twitter or on the internet. And so, like, being in a community like that is super important, and that's what the Tour Junkies have. That's what I've been trying to model, is, like, build a community, and I basically got that idea from these motherfathers. So once again,
on the Discord, like, people join the Discord because they're like, oh, I want to get this betting inside and all this stuff. They stay because of the community.
Yep.
You know, and they might join because they're like, oh, I want to chat with DB and Pat on, you know, once on Monday, twice on Wednesdays. I want to do that. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, they realize quickly, dude, there are people in here way smarter than me and Pat. Like, you need to be listening to what that dude's doing. And this guy's sharing a spreadsheet for you that you need to be reading and you need to be looking at. Like, the community is really what makes it. That's what keeps people there.
Exactly right. Hey, I appreciate your time. Everybody, that is the end of episode 3. When is episode 4 going to be out? I have no fucking idea. Okay, I wait until I find somebody I want to talk to at a time that's relevant. So I would expect it probably in the next month, but no promises. I hope you've enjoyed this show, guys. But most of all, I hope you enjoy this outro.